is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. A revolutionary when it comes to animal welfare, Dr. Temple Grandin has helped transform the livestock industry by encouraging more humane practices on ranches, farms, and at slaughter facilities. A professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University, Dr. Grandin has said that much of her life's work and outlook is influenced by being autistic. Dr. Temple Grandin spoke on the UW La Crosse campus recently. She joins me in the studio along with WISM reporter Brad Williams. Dr. Grandin, I'm wondering if you can just first talk about if you remember that point in your life when you decided, I want to work for animal welfare. I want to really make this a part of my life's work.
Well, a lot of things you kind of gradually get into. I get asked all the time, well, how did you even get interested in cattle in the first place? Because I got exposed to them when I was a teenager. Students get interested in things they get exposed to. And one of the things that helped me in working with animals is I'm an extreme visual thinker. So one of the first things I started doing was looking at what were cattle seeing when they were going through the chutes? Sunbeams, shadows, vehicles parked next to chutes. I mean, people hadn't thought about looking at that. And then some of my later work, which I think really made a difference, was developing an objective scoring system for slaughter plants. Instead of saying, well, this place is good or bad, how do we measure it? Kind of like traffic rules. You know, if you have more than three cattle mooing and bellowing in the stun box area, then the plant fails the audit. It's very, very simple outcome-based measurements.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit more about just the different practices that you really did revolutionize.
Well, when I was young, back in the 70s, I thought if I built the right equipment, I could fix everything. You know, equipment's only part of the equation. The other part of the equation is the management. And the older I get, the more and more I want to emphasize the management. And that's why I'm interested in things like the subjective scoring system. Because then you can measure, is your cattle handling getting better or your pig handling getting better or is it getting worse? Because you manage things that you measure. And I discuss this measurement system in a book I have called Improving Animal Welfare, a Practical Approach. Also in another book I got, Animals Make Us Human.
And, you know, some people may say, well, the livestock or the pigs, they're heading to the slaughterhouse. What difference does it make?
Well, they feel pain. They feel fear. And that's one of the reasons why we should not be doing things to them that are bad. What's very important, give that animal a life worth living. And sometimes people have said to me, well, how can you care about animals but be involved in sending them to the slaughterhouse? Well, I kind of figured out back in the early 90s when I worked on a big piece of equipment with one of the large plants, looked out over all these cattle out in the stockyards, and I thought they would have never have been born. But we've got to give them a life worth living. And one of my biggest concerns right now is what I call biological system overload. You know, the dairy cow, we're pushing her for more and more and more and more production. Lameness in dairy cows, problems with sore feet, is at high levels, like 25%. There's a point where we need to start thinking about what's optimal, not what is maximum.
So you do look at other industries beyond maybe the beef industry or the hog industry. You do work within the dairy industry, too.
Yeah, I've done some stuff with the dairy industry. And what I found with the meat plants, they've actually gotten quite good now because they've had companies like McDonald's audited them. Also, the USDA has gotten a whole lot more strict. But some of the problems I'm seeing now, I'm going to have to fix at the farm. Half-dead, really skinny dairy cows. Let's mark them before they get to that point. Really wild cattle that see their first man on foot when they get to a plant. See, an animal is a visual thinker, so the man on foot is a different picture than the man on the horse. They need to get trained to both. And this is mainly a problem out west, not a problem here. You can get pigs where they've never had a person walk through them in their pen. And if the first time a person walks in their pen on shipping day, the pigs are going to be screeching and going crazy. They need to get trained to people walking through them long before it's time to go to the meat plant. Also, let's look at some meat quality issues. That last 5 minutes, you can wreck pork.
Electric really?
Prods, getting them screaming and excited, last 5 minutes, you're going to get more pale, soft, watery meat. Cattle, electric prods, excitement, last 5 minutes, tougher meat.
So when you mention something like in the dairy industry, how sometimes you'll come across a farm and there may be a cow who's way too skinny or maybe they're on their feet too much, when you experience something like that, do you generally work with the individual farmer, or is this something that you say, how can we change this? Because I'm sure this is going on at other farms.
Well, one of the problems we're getting with the dairy cow, I think we're just pushing that biology too hard. You know, the dairy cow is putting so much into her meat, her milk, that there's nothing left of the cow. They're losing all the fat in their body, all the fat in their feet. And interestingly, as I travel around the world, the British dairy industry and the dairies in China, I was in China in June, are going with the Australian and the New Zealand Holstein because their feedstuffs are extremely expensive. They don't produce as much milk, but they also don't eat as much.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Temple Grandin, an animal rights and autism advocacy leader. She's a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. Our next question comes from WISM's Brad Williams.
When you make such suggestions as to how to change the breeding of the cattle and the raising or any of the other animals, are your ideas accepted readily by the farmer or by the corporation, or does it take a bit of urging and saying, well, experiment with it a little bit and see if you don't get better results?
Well, I found that selling people the magic new piece of equipment, that's easy. People always buy the thing before they will do the management. But I've been somebody in the industry to kind of see problems before they come. Like there's been problems with feeding too many beta agonists and getting lame cattle. And I was one of the first people to see that problem. And they'll go, oh, well, it's just anecdotal. But then there's a point where I'm seeing problems in enough different places that it's no longer anecdotal. You might ask, what brings about change? Okay, the equipment, that's easy. But how about just rough handling? The thing that stopped it in the meatpacking plants is when McDonald's and Wendy's, this was back in 1999, started auditing plants, and they threw a few plants off the approved supplier list for, you know, being rough with cattle or with pigs. And when you got a big customer insisting on that, that makes change. Hate to say it, but that's the way it was. And then eventually you can kind of change the culture. But in the beginning, they had to be pushed to change.
In studying some of the other countries where food is produced, what sort of things might they be better off doing to try to decrease hunger, for example, and make sure some of these other countries are producing the food that they need?
Well, I read an article just the other day in one of the cattle magazines or livestock magazines about food waste. Don't hold me to these exact figures, but I was looking at things like wastes of different food just in people's homes, and it's something awful like certain foods with 20% of it was getting wasted. That's the first thing. We need to be cutting down on food waste. And I just got asked this morning about what I thought about the whole pink slime debacle. Well, if you stop using that finely textured meat, you know, a great big huge gigantic plant is going to throw away an entire truckload of live cattle every single day. Now, it should have been labeled. You don't want to be surprising consumers. But if we don't save that product, these great big plants do 5,000 head of cattle a day. You'd just be taking a semi-load of cattle to dump and shooting them, and we shouldn't be wasting that food, but it does need to be on the label.
I want to steer to a different direction. You're, of course, also known because of your experience with autism, and there has been a good deal of progress made in understanding that condition over the years. But I also notice that it seems to be at the point in America where people are getting a fear about it that it's going to be, it's one out of 100. It's one out of 50. Has the research into autism improved people's lives, or are we getting to a point where people are becoming unnecessarily afraid of having autism in the family?
Well, autism is a very big spectrum, yes. And there'd be no radio station here without some autism to invent things like radio stations. You see, a little bit of the trait gives an advantage. Too much of the trait, you get an extreme handicap. That's something we've learned in animal breeding, too. Too much of a little bit of a trait, good. Too much of a trait, you've got a problem that's really bad. And autism goes all the way from Einstein and half the people in Silicon Valley to somebody so handicapped they can't dress themselves. Now, I think some of the increase is increased detection. You know, kids that we used to just call geeks and nerds and things like that, now they're getting a mild autism diagnosis. And the other problem is social rules are not being taught in the strict way that they were taught in the 50s. In the 50s, if I put my elbows on the table, my mother would say, put your elbows on your lap. You were given the instruction.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Temple Grandin. She's an animal rights and autism advocacy leader, and she's a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. I wanted to ask you a couple other questions about the farming industry and the livestock industry as well. You know, every now and then these videos surface of maybe a worker within a dairy plant or a livestock facility mistreating animals. I mean, would you say that those are representative of the industry? Are those mostly isolated incidences that do get blown up sometimes?
Well, I think a good way to put it is to say that people beating up dairy cows is representative. That'd be like saying that pictures of drunken driving accidents is representative of driving. But the thing that I'm seeing, unfortunately, the dairy industry has got more of these bad videos. The worst recent videos that are out there right now are dairy. Because the pig videos that have come out more recently, yeah, they might, you know, take a few too many pigs. They've flipped a few pigs over. But it's not showing the really bad stuff. Unfortunately, some of the worst stuff that's out there right now, it's some of the dairy stuff.
Will you ever reach a perfect state in the dairy industry, the livestock industry, the pork industry?
Nothing in the world can ever be made perfect. It's in the practical world. And I think one of the problems we've got today is you've got a lot of young people today that have never done hands-on things. The practical world is never going to be perfect. You can get it really good. But, right, I'm sorry, a dairy industry, but you've got some problems. And I just want to let everybody know, I'm not a vegan. I eat lots of dairy products. I love ice cream. I had some for lunch, and meat and bacon and things like that. But we've got to do things right.
You mentioned kind of the effects that McDonald's had on different processing facilities being audited and whatnot. But what are some other more recent strides that the industry has taken that you think are a step in the right direction? And what more can be done?
Well, the slaughter plants, that's one of the areas where they've gotten a whole lot better. You know, I've been around since the 70s. And boy, I can remember the 80s and the early 90s. That's when the meat industry was really bad. They were just out of control. And then in the late 90s, McDonald's and Wendy's started enforcing things. I spend a lot of my time right now working on guidelines of big corporations, and I kind of use the approach sort of like traffic rules. Think about it. There's only about three things the police really need to enforce for safety. Okay, the drunken driving stuff, texting while driving, stopping violations, and speeding. Most of the other stuff doesn't matter that much. Okay, what are some of the most critical control points? First of all, you got to make sure there's not out-and-out abuse. But one really big thing on the farm is lameness, sore feet. The dairy industry's got a lot of problems with that. The swine industry had a lot of problems, and they've actually started to correct some of their problems with leg conformation.
Here in southwest Wisconsin, we have some of the highest concentrations of organic farms. You know, some are beef producers,
yep.
Some are dairy producers, poultry, whatnot.
Yeah.
But is the organic industry, is that anything you ever work with?
Yep, I've worked on organic things, too. And one of the biggest things, the organic standard makes it very clear that you cannot use antibiotics. But if you have a sick animal and you don't treat it, that'd be really, really bad for welfare. The organic standard makes it clear that that animal has to be treated and then taken off the program. But I've seen some people cheat on that. Lice all over cattle, hair falling out. And then people get used to seeing that and say, well, it's normal in the spring for the hair fall out. No, it's not normal. And with the organic animals, you're going to need to use hardier animals. You see, if you just breed an animal for production, you tend to lose some of the immune function. There's always trade-offs in things. In fact, I write about this in a textbook I've done called Behavior and the Genetics of Domestic Animals.
I mean, is there a way, and maybe are there people who are working on finding that happy medium within the organic meat industry, especially when you talk about, you know, you're sacrificing your organic status for treating and making sure that the cow isn't sick?
Well, in anything, you got different people, you know, do better at things than other people. I've been over to Europe, you know, and I got a zillion regulations and things like that, but I think actually our slaughter plants are better than Europe. I've been reading some of the literature, and I was reading a paper in one of the scientific journals about a plant in Italy. Their stress levels were so horrible, I couldn't believe it. Our plants, by using the numerical scoring, I'm not going to say they're perfect, but our federally inspected plants are doing better than a lot of places in Europe are doing.
I've read before that you say that you feel with your autism you're able to relate to animals in a way that's unique. Can you talk about that?
Animals are sensory-based thinkers. They don't think in language. And when you think in sensory, it's going to be pictures. You know, like, for example, animals can get fear memories. I met a horse that was terrified of black hats because during a veterinary procedure, somebody had thrown alcohol in his eyes and that person was wearing a black hat. White hats were okay. Black hats were bad. You see, that's animal thinking that's very specific. You want to understand animal behavior. You've got to get away from verbal language.
Before, when Brad Williams of Wisdom Radio had asked you just about autism, this reminded me of a quote I found of yours that I just found really touching. You had said, "The world needs all kind of minds." I love that.
Well, let me give you an example. And I'm going to be talking about that in many of the talks that I've done. I'm a visual thinker. Now, there's another kind of mind that's a mathematical thinker. They think in patterns. So you need to have the visual thinker and the engineers working together. Steve Jobs was an artist. So an artist invented the interface on the iPhone, and then the engineers had to make it work. Also, all you people that want everybody to learn algebra, now it screens out a lot of visual thinkers. You need us visual thinkers, because you need us to prevent accidents like the Fukushima nuclear power plant. When I found out why those reactors melted down, I'm going, how could you do that? How could you put all your emergency equipment in a non-waterproof basement? If they'd had some very simple crank-em-shut submarine doors, it would not have happened.
I do want to talk a bit more about education, and I'm just going to throw in some numbers here. According to the Autism Society, obviously autism is on the rise, and as you said, maybe it's because there's more detection, maybe
especially
more.
On the very, very mild, what okay. I would call geeks and nerds, because I've been out to Silicon Valley. I've been all the many of the major tech companies, and you've got cubicle after cubicle of programmers there that are on the spectrum. And then the human resources people say, oh, we know they're on the spectrum. We don't talk about it. That was what one human resources person at a major company told me last year in 2013.
Wow. So in the year 2000, the Autism Society says that 1 in 150 children were born with autism. In the year 2010, that number jumped to 1 in 68 births. And as you said, you know, people are talking about it more. Maybe human resources people are not talking about it more.
They're out in Silicon Valley. They end up working in the tech industry, and they're not
sure.
Very social. But I think some of it is, in my generation, social rules were taught in a much more rigid way. Kids were taught how to shake hands. They were taught how to have table manners. So if you're a little socially awkward, you actually did better. So some of that increase, I think, is increased detection, especially on the real mild end. I think there is some severe stuff that's been increasing, you know. And also, get out in the tech community and you take two programmers or two radio station engineers and they get married. You're concentrating that genetics. It's a continuous trait, thousands of little tiny snips in the DNA, and then you're more likely to get a kid that remains nonverbal.
So, you mentioned that, certain HR people are saying, yes, we know that our workers maybe are on the autism spectrum, but we don't talk about it. I am curious about that. When it comes to adults living with autism, maybe people who have severe cases that...
The problem you got is there's a big difference between dealing with just a geeky, nerdy kid. You got to teach them some social skills, teach them some work skills. Boy, I wish paper routes were still around. I'd put every single one of these 12-year-olds on a paper route. And we
autism
need
or not?
All of them.
All of them.
Kids have got to learn work skills. When I was 13, I had a little sewing job. And when I was 15, I cleaned 8 horse stalls every day. And it's a discipline and a responsibility for working. And I think all kids need to learn that.
Do you think the education system currently is, just because more people are more aware of autism, do you think school districts are really handling students with autism in ways possible? Obviously, every school district.
I'm not going to make a generalization about school districts. I travel around to a whole lot of different places, and I find so much depends upon the particular place, the particular school. I'm seeing some situations with the great outcomes, other situations with bad outcomes. And one of the big problems I'm seeing is too much overprotecting of these kids. You got to stretch these kids. When I was a little kid, I had to be party hostess at my mother's parties. And my brother had to do it, too. It helped him to get a job as a big bank vice president. So it wasn't just the autistic kid that had to do it, but you got to stretch these kids. You got to take them just outside the comfort zone. I'm seeing too many kids that don't know how to shake hands, do not know how to shop. They don't. The parents do all the talking for them. We got to have a little less helicopter parents.
So what is working? What do you think are the best programs in schools that work for students who have autism?
Well, I'm going to just talk about things we need to do. Okay, if you got a three-year-old that's not talking, I don't care what the diagnosis is. I really don't care because the treatment's the same. Your three-year-old's not talking. Okay, make sure there isn't something physically wrong with the throat. Okay, you rule out those kind of problems. You need to have a teacher. Teach them nursery rhymes. Teach them words. Teach them turn-taking. You got to teach these kids turn-taking. The worst thing you can do is let them sit in the corner rocking and tuning out. And then when they're getting to elementary school, build on strengths. My ability in art was always encouraged. An ability in art became the basis of a design career. So build on the strength. You got a third grader that's good in math, let him have the high school math book. Don't hold him back. Get him online and learn some computer programming. We have got to control the video game playing. I'm hearing way too much. He's 21, I can't get him out of the basement. I'm hearing way too much of that. They're ending up on Social Security. Teenagers have got to learn work skills. Got to. Also, when they get bullied and teased in school, let's get them into activities where there's a shared interest. Because the only places where I was not bullied and teased was electronics lab and horseback riding, where I was in with other students with shared interests. That's another really important thing. And then out in the work world, learn to sell your work rather than yourself. Put together a portfolio of your work. So I'd go to interview a plant or interview a ranch, and I just laid out my drawings, and that's how I sold jobs.
Your work speaks for itself.
That's right. That's what I did.
Do you feel like workplaces have to do more to work with adults with autism? As you said, in Silicon Valley, maybe there are plenty of places. But...
Well, the main thing in the workplace is you cannot be subtle. There's a scene in the HBO movie about me where my boss slams down the deodorant and says, "You stink, use it." And his secretaries took me out shopping for better clothes.
Was that real?
That's real. That is real. And I was very angry at the time, but now I thank that boss. So maybe I'm a little bit eccentric. In the workplace, if the person's, let's say you want to train somebody to be a museum tour guide. A lot of museums will take them as young as 12. Great job. Somebody's got to demonstrate the correct distance you stand, how to approach a client. You don't just follow them around and stalk them. So you might say, watch how Susie does it, and I want you to copy how Susie does it. Or if it's, let's say it's a programming job, you don't just say to them, well, develop new software. That's too vague. You might say, I want a phone app that does some specific thing. It's got to work on this platform, use this programming language where there's a specific outcome. It can only use a certain amount of memory. It's got to do some specific thing. And it can be a really hard thing, but be specific, not vague.
Well, Dr. Granit, is there anything else that you want to talk about or any final thoughts you have for listeners?
Well, we've got to develop kids' strengths. Build up the thing they're good at. And the other thing, put your portfolio on your phone. Because another thing I learned is you never know where you're going to find the person that can open the door. He might be sitting next to him on the bus. Maybe it's some techie guy that's got a techie company ID hanging around his neck. You whip that phone out. Show them some programming you've got on it, and you've got a job. Lots of times people just don't see where the door to opportunity is. It's right there, but they don't see it.
Dr. Temple Grandin has been a leader in helping institute humane animal treatment practices in the livestock industry. She's a professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. She's also an advocate for people with autism. She lives with a high-functioning form of autism known as Asperger's syndrome. We'd also like to thank Brad Williams of Wisdom Radio for helping to ask questions during Dr. Grandin's recent visit to UW-La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.